It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Welcome to Dig, a history podcast. Welcome to the third episode in our series on the history of abortion and birth control in America. We left off in our last episode discussing the conservatism of the late 1940s and the 1950s and how that affected women's reproductive rights. Today, we're picking up there to talk more about women's reproductive health in the late 20th century with some big key events, Roe v. Wade and the invention of the hormonal birth control pill. I'm Elizabeth Garner Masaryk.
And I'm Sarah Hanley Cousins.
And we are your historians for this episode of Dig.
In the 1950s and 60s, healthcare became more consolidated in medical hands. Hospitals began developing abortion panels to protect themselves from lawsuits and surveillance from the state. Because of this, it became much harder to obtain a therapeutic abortion, and women's needs and their knowledge of their own bodies, something we talked about a lot in the last episode, was completely taken out of the official decision-making by doctors and the state. During the 50s and 60s, abortions were pushed underground, and the death rate rose. Particularly, this affected women of color. The rising death rate prompted both feminists and medical personnel, including psychiatrists, to begin pushing for more lenient abortion laws. And one thing to remember, and that's clear from the historical record, is that abortion and birth control were needed and widely practiced throughout the 20th century. The only thing that changed were the means for procuring abortion and birth control as the medical and state surveillance changed. The increased restrictions and policing on abortions during the post-war period drove the death rate up. And of course, the death rate from illegal abortion was higher for women of color because they had limited access to safe hospital abortions. In New York City, between 1951 and 1962, illegal abortion-related deaths for women of color doubled. In Cook County Hospital in Chicago, the number of illegal abortion-related complications treated rose from about 1,000 per year in 1939 to over 3,000 per year in 1959. Government estimates in the late 1960s and 1970s estimated that annual illegal abortion rates each year fluctuated between 200,000 and 1.2 million. It's really staggering numbers there.
These are, and you know, just as a side note, like Cook County or you know the Chicago Hospital basically had to create an entire ward just to take care of women who were coming in with complications from illegal abortions.
That's unbelievable.
It is. It really is. That's why we're telling the story,
right? Yeah.
If women of color were able to gain access to a hospital abortion, many were actually forced to accept sterilization in return.
Right.
A Chicago study in the 1940s showed that 67% of women who received abortions at a particular hospital servicing low-income patients were also sterilized. Many Black women across the country were sterilized against their will or their knowledge well into the late 1960s.
Yeah, it wasn't, and sorry to kind of jump in here, but from what I understand, it may have actually, though, now that I say this, not been tied as much to abortion as it was to deliveries, births. But in California and in the Southwest, wasn't there a rash of Chicana women who were sterilized also.
Absolutely. Chicana women and then also the Native American population also as well. So basically, if a woman was going in for any kind of gynecological,
right,
I don't want to say surgery, but birth
service,
abortion,
yeah,
service. Yeah. Birth, abortion, asking for birth control, what have you. It was always kind of this give and take. Well, mm-hmm, you know what? You can get this if in return you get sterilized. Right. And that's if consent was even asked. A lot of the times consent wasn't asked,
right,
and women would find out well after the fact.
They woke up from twilight sleep or something like, mm-hmm, that, and they had been sterilized.
Or even many years later.
Right.
There's lots of instances of women not even knowing this happened to them until they were trying to have a child with,
yes,
their husband later in life and went in and asked, why can't I get pregnant? And the doctor's,
right,
like, well, you're sterile.
Yeah.
More affluent white women with hospital and doctor connections were much more likely to receive a therapeutic abortion than working class women or people of color. A study in New York found that white women who were private patients at area hospitals, so private patients meaning could pay out of pocket, essentially, they received therapeutic abortions in numbers 4 times greater than women in public hospital wards, whether they were white, black, or Puerto Rican. Class inequality was practically built into the system. For example, a San Francisco hospital allowed private patients to have a therapeutic abortion with the approval of only one staff obstetrician. On the other hand, public clinic cases required the review of the entire OBGYN staff, and then a vote was taken by 9 professors that was on the staff. For the most part, women did not voluntarily talk about abortion in public. And I think one thing that we might want to just remind our listeners, too, is a therapeutic abortion. So although abortions were illegal, there was this gray area in the law where a therapeutic abortion could be performed legally. And so what that ends up doing is that women who have private access to healthcare professionals that, quote unquote, trust them, right, that they have a relationship with, those women who can afford that kind of relationship with a doctor are getting therapeutic abortions at a much higher rate than working class women and women who can't afford kind of this one-on-one privacy with a doctor, right, who are having to go into hospitals, charity hospitals,
right? Yeah.
You know, or publicly funded hospitals.
Right.
So it creates an inequality in the care basically between demographics and between class.
Right.
Economically.
Right. And another thing that maybe we should clarify again, I think we talked about this in the last episode, but just as a reminder that when we say therapeutic abortion, we mean that that's an abortion that's performed, obviously, as you indicated, by a physician. Because abortion is illegal, you can go to your doctor and essentially they make the case that the abortion is therapeutic. There's a medical need for that abortion, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It therapeutic sort of makes it sound as though there are extenuating circumstances, right? That it's
right,
like maybe like psychological.
Well, and that's kind of what I wanted to go back to. I mean, at the beginning, mm-hmm, or earlier, you had mentioned one of us had
psychiatrists,
mentioned, you know, that, yeah, psychiatrists start pushing for this, so because therapeutic abortions, that's one of the reasons that especially white women are getting them. Mm. Like it's going to be a psychological burden,
okay, so
on this woman.
It is almost
has,
therapeutic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So therapeutic covers the gamut from there is a medical problem and somebody's,
right,
going to die if this abortion doesn't happen, mm-hmm, to this is going to create a hardship for this woman, whether she has,
right,
7 kids or she's not ready to have a kid or
right,
whatever, you know, so
right,
psychiatrists kind of start becoming part of the conversation.
Right. Yeah.
Which has been part of the conversation, as we talked about in the last one, in the 1930s, you know, women couldn't afford more children. So they want to have abortions or they want to get birth control. So it's not like the conversation changed. It's just, again, kind of discourse in the law and the medical profession and their interaction with women seeking abortion changes,
right,
as time goes on. For the most part, women did not voluntarily talk about abortion in public. However, this changed in the 1960s, and 3 major incidents really changed public discourse about abortion.
In 1961, West German pediatricians noticed that the number of babies born with the deformity of shortened limbs had tripled since the year before. Doctors figured out that thalidomide, a drug used in sleeping pills, cough syrups, and other over-the-counter medications sold in West Germany and England, was the cause of these deformities. The drug also caused many brain-damaged babies, miscarriages, stillbirths, and early infant deaths. Although it wasn't in wide use in America, physicians had handed out over 1,000 pills to their American patients. Sherry Finkbein was an American woman who had taken a sleeping pill containing thalidomide and saw a therapeutic abortion after learning of the high risk of birth defects. She was the first woman to publicly share her desire to have an abortion and gained the support and, of course, the ire of many Americans. Finkbein was a white middle-class mother, pregnant with her fifth child, who talked openly with the press about her sadness as she learned of the damage done to her developing fetus. The press followed her story closely and watched as doctors denied her a therapeutic abortion for fear of prosecution. Finkbein and her husband traveled to Sweden to obtain an abortion. A Gallup poll showed that 52% of Americans agreed that she had done, quote, the right thing. I just want to pause here for 1 second to say that it's sort of a story in my husband's family that his grandmother, his family is from Scotland, his grandmother took thalidomide throughout her pregnancy with my husband's father. And so they narrowly avoided, I guess, any problems because he was born, you know, with no abnormalities. So I just think that that's an interesting reminder that this was not very long ago. Right?
No,
people that we know
yes.
took thalidomide during their lives.
Right.
So just, I think that that's really interesting. A rubella epidemic hit the west coast of the United States in 1963, and by 1965 had spread across the United States and proved to be the largest rubella epidemic in 20 years. Infectious disease specialists warned Americans that pregnant women who contracted rubella within the early stages of pregnancy were at a 50% higher risk of delivering a baby with serious malformations and limited brain capability. CBS Television News announced that rubella was a, quote, far more widespread threat to unborn babies than even thalidomide. This, again, increased the public discourse on abortion and the rights of women to legally obtain them. At this, I find really interesting because you can avoid thalidomide, mm-hmm. right? You can just not take thalidomide.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very different story to try to avoid an infectious disease that's rampaging across the United States.
Right.
And going off of that, I think that this is very much a conversation that's happening right now, or maybe has died down in recent months, but certainly over the summer, the concern over the birth defects caused by the Zika virus in Central and South America,
mm-hmm.
Babies being born with microcephaly. Right. Being born with very, very small brains or with almost no brain at all.
Yeah.
And that has reawakened the debate in Central and South America about whether or not to make abortion legal. And so it sort of reawakened conversations in those countries about, you know, if we are at risk of these terrible birth defects, then we need to have access to what, you know, they might term therapeutic abortions.
Right. And Zika, we should remind listeners, is contracted from mosquitoes.
Right. So,
right. So you
again,
cannot avoid
right.
mosquitoes.
Yeah.
They sneak in everywhere.
Right.
Yeah. So back to the U.S. 1960s and the subsequent demand for abortion by primarily white middle-class women, it really changed the discourse about abortion from one of shame and, quote, back alley butchers to a discussion about medical informed consent, disability, and the right not to give birth. By changing the discourse or the talk to one of quality of life for both mother and potentially disabled babies, pregnant women and many in the medical profession impacted the politics of abortion. The rubella epidemic caused a cultural and a social change surrounding the understanding of abortion. And I think, too, just to kind of bang people over the head with this, like once white women start talking about
right.
it, then it's okay.
Yeah.
Right. Then it's okay to talk about it.
Right. And I think, too,
and
that
I want to say in quotes, okay.
Right. Yeah.
Since you guys can't see me.
Yeah. It's not, you know, all of a sudden it's perfectly fine, perfectly acceptable. But I think also, not only that it's white middle-class women, that's certainly a huge part of it, but also that it's the reason that they're seeking abortions is this thing that's outside of their control, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's beyond their control.
Mm-hmm.
They're not asking for abortion access because they had extramarital sex and they don't want to have a baby, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is almost divorcing it from the morality issues around sexuality, mm-hmm. and instead saying, I'm an even better mother because I don't want my baby to suffer, mm-hmm. changes the way that people talk about this, about abortion.
Absolutely. So something like is biologically natural, in quotes as well, as reproduction actually kind of becomes a construct of cultural and social environment in this period. So the rubella epidemic of the 60s, it changed the social aspect of the politics of abortions, and it makes it more acceptable to many people and doctors when it is kind of divorced from its sexuality,
right,
in a way. So these two causes of birth defects increase the public discourse over the authority of the state, or even over doctors themselves, that they had in matters of women's health, caused serious questioning of pre-existing laws surrounding medicine and abortion, such as patient rights, informed consent, disability, and racial discrimination in healthcare.
Now, this brings us, I think, to a really important point in this story, a very contentious point in this story. Although I say that this is an episode that's entirely about abortion and birth control. I think everything is contentious, right?
This episode is making some people very,
very
angry.
Mad. As the other ones have. But we have something here that very much continues to be a real topic of contention, or real bone of contention, I should say. And that's this linking of disability and abortion. Mm-hmm. The women who advocated for abortion access because of the threat of rubella or of thalidomide were doing so because of the perceived threat of rubella-related disability or thalidomide-related mm-hmm. disabilities. Women who feared their children may be disabled as a result of those things in the 1960s were operating within a society that feared and hated disabilities. Children were warehoused, kept in institutions, and stigmatized. Children with differences that today could be managed, people who could grow up and navigate society, like people with Down syndrome, were strongly encouraged by their doctors to be taken to institutions rather than to live at home with their families, meaning that these kinds of disabilities were almost invisible. They almost didn't exist. You certainly would not have the kind of mainstreaming or inclusion in schools that we have today, which leads many of us to have grown up with people that have intellectual or developmental differences, right? Mm-hmm. That didn't exist at the time. So it was almost as though this was invisible. So you didn't see these children in the classroom or in the church or in the grocery store. There were no educational opportunities, no IDEA or ADA. So for many women, abortion was the safer and perhaps in their minds, more loving choice. But the connection between disability and abortion was also really problematic and remains really problematic. Mm-hmm. They were making the assumption that a life with a disability is so abnormal, so atrocious, that it's better to just not be born. Yet many disability activists argue now that the reason that life was so quote unquote horrific for disabled children in the 60s was not because of the inherent differences or needs that come with a disability, but because of society itself that created that inaccessibility and stigma. Mm-hmm. Of course, this gets into the differences in the modes of understanding disability, right? We have a medical model of disability that's really the hegemonic or overarching one, which says that disability is a medical problem that can be and should be cured by doctors.
Right.
But the one that disability activists and scholars espouse is the social model, which actually argues that the only reason disabilities are disabilities is because of society, because of an ableist society that makes it difficult, sometimes impossible for people to live typical lives.
Right. It's the difference between building stairs and building ramps.
In exactly.
A very simplistic term.
Right.
If you're trying to wrap your head around that.
Exactly.
Why do
right.
we have to build stairs? Why can't we have ramps everywhere? I mean,
right.
If you can think of it in those terms, you can kind of see the difference between a medical model yeah. and a social model.
Yeah. You're not really disabled if you live in a society where you can do everything that everyone else can do because of the way that your environment is structured. Right.
Right.
The disability stops existing.
Right.
In a sense, of course, you know, the physical difference, the bodily difference is still there, but it's not disabling, if that made sense.
Does that make sense? Okay. Absolutely. Yeah.
This gets, I have so much of an easier time explaining this in like academia speak than I do when, like, real people talk.
Yeah.
I was teaching this to my students the other day, and I was, like, really struggling to translate it. And I think they got it eventually, but...
Yeah. Well, I mean, I even hesitated bringing up the idea of, like, stairs versus ramps, because then you're only thinking of disabilities in a physical sense.
Exactly, yeah.
You know? I mean, it's so much deeper than that, and maybe we should do a whole podcast on this
I think that's a great idea.
Try to break it apart.
The other example that I gave my students two examples to sort of wrap their heads around this, and one was that I was at a conference once where one of the keynote speakers used a wheelchair, and the two speakers ahead of this person, the first one went up, and the podium was on a stage. Mm. Went up onto the stage, gave their part of the talk, came down. Second person up on stage, gave their talk at the podium, came down. Came to the third person, the person who used the wheelchair, and it was only then that all of the organizers of the conference and everyone who was there realized that there was actually no way for him to get onto the stage. And there was no movable mic. So he ended up giving his part of the talk from the, you know, bottom of the stage where no one could hear him because of the physical environment that he was giving this talk in. Mm-hmm. The other example that I gave my students to try to combat this idea that disabilities are only physical was about autism and having more spaces in our society that are low stimulus, right? Like low light, low sound, kind of safe environments for autistic children without the kind of triggering things, lights, noises, chaos, right? That can sometimes trigger autistic children into kind of panic. And how we really only find that in places that are having a dedicated, like, afternoon for children with autism, mm-hmm. right? Instead mm-hmm. of just that being the norm. So,
and that 30 years ago, that wasn't an issue, right? Because that kind of stimulus wasn't in our face all the time.
Right.
We weren't looking at screens and mm-hmm. lights and sounds and music. Maybe not 40 years, but 60 years, you know.
Sure.
That wasn't an issue before. So now it's also in our face more.
Yeah.
And so even like the social and the cultural changes in our society then bring out other quote-unquote yeah. disabilities that maybe
right.
we didn't even know about before because that wasn't an issue.
Right. Right. And 40, 60 years ago, those children would have been institutionalized, right? They wouldn't have even been a part of our society that we would have had to think about changing those things because right. they wouldn't have been around.
Right.
That was a long story about the medical versus social model. Hopefully that was useful.
Well, but I think it is important for us to really kind of dig into that in a story or in a discussion of abortion because it yeah. makes it really sticky. And I mean,
yeah.
it has to be brought up and it has mm-hmm. to be discussed. And I think sometimes pro-choice advocates tend to try to avoid that discussion.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's fair. I think we as historians need to bring it up and,
yeah.
and present everything.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so this remains a really hotly debated subject, as many people, many pro-choice advocates still believe that you should have the right to abort if a fetus is disabled. This is something called selective abortion. While disability rights activists, on the other hand, argue that this is based on the assumption that disabled lives are not worth living. This is also often extended further, that aborting fetuses with disabilities is actually the beginning of a slippery slope. What's to stop us then from simply aborting all fetuses diagnosed with, say, Down syndrome, and eliminating Down syndrome or minimizing it as much as possible from the population? That's eugenics,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
that's bioengineering the human race.
Mm-hmm.
However, it is important to articulate here that disability rights activists are not anti-abortion. However, the position is more that they're pro-all choice. In other words, the choice to not have an abortion if you're carrying a fetus with a disability. The fear is that there may come a time when it's required, either by law or by pressure or by stigma, to abort all disabled fetuses. And this has become even more of an issue of debate in recent years as we've been able to screen for disabilities and abnormalities earlier and earlier and earlier in pregnancies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that's of concern right now is that while no, there aren't any laws that say that, you know, you had this blood test and your blood test says that you're likely to be having a child with Down syndrome, you have to have an abortion, right? There's no laws that say that. But the concern right now is that when you have that testing very, very early, and the doctor looks at you and says, do you understand what you're getting into? This is going to be so difficult. You begin thinking about all of the money and the time and the rest of your life being, you know, sunk into caring for a child with profound disabilities, and that pressures people into having abortions that aren't necessary. And it further stigmatizes disabilities that if we stopped stigmatizing them and instead kind of poured energy into creating a less ableist society, they would be less disabling. Those ailments or those abnormalities would be less disabling.
Right.
I think also in our society, and especially as there's criticism against government spending, education spending, the growth of things like disability and Social Security disability funding, Medicare, Medicaid, a lot of those debates also have relevance to the lives of people with disabilities, especially disabled children, right? If we cut Medicaid, that cuts a lot of the services that these children rely on. And so that, I think, is part of this fear that if we're trying to cut down on government spending, maybe that could be then kind of rolled into a pressure to eliminate people with disabilities from the human race, right? Because then it becomes, well, why did you choose to have a child with Down syndrome? Why did you choose to have a child with spina bifida when you could have aborted and avoided this public charge?
Right, right. All right, so back to our narrative back in the 1960s. Many Americans believed that the decision to have an abortion should remain a private one between a woman and her doctor. Ironically, in the 20th century, physicians became some of the leading voices championing more liberalized abortion accessibility. So if you remember back in our first episode on family limitation in America, physicians were the ones trying to regulate abortion so that they would have more professional power over women's reproduction and over kind of the medical field in general. But by 1967, a survey found that 87% of American physicians favored a liberalization of the country's abortion laws. On the contrary, those against access to abortion, especially the Catholic Church, began to form a stronger movement in opposition to relaxing abortion laws. Feminism and resistance at the grassroots level also became a driving force towards laws against abortion repeal. Underground movements such as Jane in Chicago and the Society for Humane Abortion in California created their own illegal abortion networks in order to provide safe abortions for those seeking them. Between 1967 and 1973, Jane in Chicago provided approximately 3,000 safe but illegal abortions per year.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, when you read, like, this was all just an underground network, right? And these women were basically teaching each other how to do this. And then, you know, if you needed an abortion, word on the street, you go to Jane, you know, and you'd go, and it was safe, it was sterile, you know, they were using medical grade equipment.
Right.
I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, and one thing that I've already begun hearing in recent days in our current political environment is feminists starting to imagine a future in which we have to have systems like Jane again, to try to kind of almost create an underground railroad of sorts where women from states with very restrictive abortion access like Texas can be sort of transported by like-minded women up to states like New York, which it's very likely will continue to have abortion access, even if Roe v. Wade was to be overturned.
Yeah. I mean, right now there's an entity out of Texas. It's called Jane's Due Process.
And
it's actually, they, and forgive me if I'm getting this wrong, but they basically take donations and they help women or girls who are underage, so who need parental consent or whatever, they help them, and they either help them to get some kind of injunction or whatever to kind of overrule that, or it is that they help them go to another state to get an abortion. I can't remember which, but those kind of organizations are already in effect, and I mean, if things keep kind of moving the way that they seem to be moving, I think that, like, you're right. I mean, I think that's just going to become more and more of a reality.
Mm-hmm.
By the mid-1960s, women had formed numerous groups across the country, organizing to push the repeal of abortion laws.
Groups planned speak-outs where women publicly stood up and spoke about their illegal abortions. This move from private to public discourse greatly shifted the power dynamic in the abortion fight.
In 1970, we have the beginning of the major change in this story. In 1970, a young woman named Norma McCorvey discovered that she was pregnant with her third child. Norma had had a very difficult life. She had a really troubled childhood. She married very, very young to an abusive man who beat her when she told him that she was pregnant for the first time. So by the time she got to this third pregnancy, she really did not want another child. But it was illegal in Texas, where she lived, to get an abortion except in instances of rape or incest. Norma McCorvey then invented a horrific story that she had been gang raped while she was working at a carnival. When she realized that she was pregnant from this so-called gang rape, she sought out an abortion, but had no success in finding a doctor that would perform the procedure, even with this invented story. Getting desperate, she thought about maybe giving the child up for adoption. And so as she was trying to explore that option, she had to meet with some lawyers who might arrange for private adoptions. One of the lawyers she met with asked her if she might consider talking to another lawyer, a woman named Linda Coffey. She agreed, and not that long after, Norma McCorvey met with Linda Coffey and another attorney named Sarah Weddington, who were actually looking for a woman to be a plaintiff to challenge Texas's restrictive abortion laws. Court cases move very slowly. And though McCorvey agreed to be the plaintiff in this test case, by the time the case, you know, kind of churned its way around, McCorvey had already delivered her baby and given it up for adoption. So, you know, we'll explain how the case unfolds, but either way, you know, McCorvey didn't get her abortion. Coffey and Weddington were both female attorneys looking to make a difference. And this seemed like something that they could do to aid the women's movement with the skills that they had. In 1970, the Texas law was found unconstitutional by a 3-judge panel of the Texas District Court. It was appealed, of course, and that same year it was taken up by the Supreme Court of the United States. By this point, McCorvey was using the name Jane Roe in the case in order to protect her privacy. After all, I think it's easy to forget that this was very dangerous for her, right? To be so blatantly associated with a case asking for access to an abortion. Mm-hmm. The arguments were scheduled for December 12th, 1971. The arguments did not go smoothly. The attorneys on both sides were not necessarily primed for appearing before the highest court in the land. But as they went on, McCorvey's lawyers sharpened their talons. In a 7-2 decision led by Justice Harry Blackmun, the court ruled that the Texas law violated the right to privacy and that there was a, quote, zone of privacy around laws that attempted to legislate marriage, reproduction, and child rearing. They called upon the previous case, Griswold v. Connecticut. We're coming back to Griswold.
We're going to come back to that one, yeah.
We'll kind of roll around back to Griswold v. Connecticut and what that said in a minute, which was a case over whether or not Connecticut had the right to outlaw birth control for married couples, which had ruled that the right to privacy, in other words, privacy within a marriage, was a fundamental and substantive right, and that the state could not legislate the decisions and actions undertaken within a marriage. They sort of expanded that idea of privacy, that if you have the right to privacy within a marriage, decision-making within a marriage, women individually have the right to privacy in the decision-making over their own bodies.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this case, married women.
Correct. Wait. Oh, in Connecticut.
Right.
In Griswold v. Connecticut, right. But not in Roe.
True.
Jane Roe was not married.
True.
She had been married, but later divorced. I want to pause here just to say that the story of Jane Roe / Norma McCorvey is very, very complicated. McCorvey ultimately gave up all 3 of her children to be raised by others. Her first child, her daughter from her marriage, was raised by her mother. The other 2 were given up for adoption. Later in life, she identified as a lesbian or a bisexual. At various points, she identified with different terms. When she came out in the 1980s as the plaintiff in the case, because remember, she went as Jane Roe, so her name wasn't associated with it. In the 1980s, when she did announce that it was her, she was viciously attacked. People sent her death threats. Someone shot out the windows of her home. People called her a baby killer and spit at her on the street. She was an ardent and vocal advocate for abortion rights. But then later in life, she underwent religious conversions twice, actually. First as an evangelical Christian, and then again she converted and became Roman Catholic. And as she underwent these conversions, she publicly changed her positions and became quite conservative and very anti-abortion. At one point, she even suggested that it was pro-abortion activists who caused violence against abortion providers. In other words, they brought it upon themselves. She wasn't exactly what either side wanted as a hero. She was fascinating, complex, and entirely an individual. But at the same time, many scholars have argued that she was used by both sides of the debate. And many have criticized her for being sort of weak-willed in all of this, and that she kind of flipped from side to side on a whim and at the pressure of whoever she was associated with at that time in her life, right? Like, at one point, she's this very vocal abortion access advocate, and then at the next point, she's, you know, marching on Washington as part of the March for Life, right? Like, this very, it kind of frustrated people that she kind of could flip that easily or that simply. And I pulled this quote. This comes out of her autobiography because I think that it's really sums up something about Norma McCorvey and her role in all this. It says, "I wasn't the wrong person to become Jane Roe. I wasn't the right person to become Jane Roe. I was just the person who became Jane Roe of Roe v. Wade. And my life story, warts and all, was a little piece of history." And I think that really encapsulates this case, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. She wasn't a hero to either side all the time, but mm-hmm. she was the woman that got this done.
Right. So many of these really important Supreme Court decisions, they start out as test cases.
Right.
So, you know, in a lot of ways, the situation that drives them to the Supreme Court is, I don't know if constructed is the right word, but, you know, Jane Roe comes along at the right time when certain people are looking for the right woman to push this forward, right?
Right.
In Connecticut v. Griswold, which I'll talk about in a second, these two people that take it to the Supreme Court understand that the law has to be challenged, and so they construct a way that they can get arrested and then take it to the Supreme Court
right.
to be challenged. And yeah. this happens over and over and over again.
Yeah.
I mean, even with Rosa Parks,
exactly.
right?
Yeah.
That was in the planning. It, mm-hmm. You know, somebody was going to not get up on
Plessy
the bus.
Plessy v. Ferguson was the
right?
same thing.
Yeah. Right. Plessy v. Ferguson, mm-hmm. like he was a black man who presented as white, right? He was,
mm-hmm.
he was very racially mixed, right? Mm-hmm. So he goes and sits on the train, and the white person's part of the train, and then basically declares that he is black
right.
and forces himself to, or forces them to arrest him, you know.
Right.
To
force their hand.
To force right. their hand and then to take these cases yeah. further.
And this is so interesting to me, because what then ends up happening is that we rewrite those stories about these Supreme Court cases so that now Rosa Parks was just this poor working lady who was so tired, her feet hurt, and all she wanted to do was sit down on that bus, right?
Yeah.
And Rosa Parks was like a badass civil rights activist.
Yeah. She had been doing this for
yeah.
a long time.
And she
time.
Was like ready to get arrested, right?
right?
She
right.
was in there
as
loaded
was,
for bear.
As were other people,
yeah.
right? It's just, you know, it was the right moment, the right
exactly.
time. And that's how a lot
yeah.
of these kind of cases come about.
Right. And that also, I think, points out just how unusual Jane Roe was, because she was in the right place
right.
at the right time, but she wasn't an activist. She wasn't in it like Norma Parks, Rosa Parks was, right?
right?
She wasn't in it for the fight necessarily. She actually just kind of wanted to have an abortion and get on with her life.
But in another way, I mean, I think she probably at the time was a good test subject because A, she's working class, B, she's a white woman.
Yeah.
Right. And so in the context of the period, unfortunately, they need a white woman because they just with the racial tension.
It wouldn't have gone as it wouldn't have gone to the Supreme Court. Right.
People have more compassion for a white woman.
Mm-hmm. They wouldn't have had the same cultural cachet.
Right. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Placing abortion in the context of the naturalness of human existence has been a classic argument in the defense of abortion. And one of the most important points in the 1973 majority opinion in Roe v. Wade by Justice Blackmun upheld that abortion had been practiced and tolerated in America since the 1600s. You know, so he's basically saying in the majority opinion, look, women have been doing this since America's existence, right? So who are we to regulate?
Mm-hmm.
Another important point from this ruling is that the court stated that fetuses were not legally considered persons and therefore not covered by the Constitution. While there were and are some who believed that fetuses count as people, others do not. So there is no consensus. Texas, according to SCOTUS, was taking only one group into account. The decision in Roe, however, was still limited. While it did agree that abortion must be legal early in pregnancy, after the first trimester, they left the decision of when to restrict abortion to the states, under the argument that this was when the state's interest in protecting the potential life would be compelling. In other words, the longer the pregnancy advanced, the more complex and complicated this became. I might add that this is where most of our current legislation and fights over abortion come from today, this aspect of allowing the states to make the decision after the first trimester. And going back to the arguments in Roe v. Wade, racial discrimination and access to abortion was also used as an argument. Lawyers claimed that white women were more often able to persuade their private physicians to allow access to abortion. It was also argued that wealthy women had the means to travel to areas where abortion laws were not heavily enforced, while poor women could not. Thus, the state abortion laws were argued to be discriminatory.
So far, we've spent most of our time discussing abortion, but now we want to turn toward birth control. As we mentioned in our previous podcast, Birth Control and Abortion Before Roe v. Wade, many states enacted laws against abortion and birth control in the mid to late 19th century.
An 1879 Connecticut law that criminalized the encouragement or use of birth control stated that, quote, any person who uses any drug, medicinal article, or instrument for the purposes of preventing conception shall be fined not less than $40 or imprisoned not less than 60 days, end quote. The law further stated that, quote, any person who assists, abets, counsels, causes, hires, or commands another to commit any offense may be prosecuted and punished as if he were the principal offender. By the 1960s, women's rights and birth control itself had come a long way since these laws in the 1870s.
We talked a great deal last time about birth control pioneer Margaret Sanger, who was the founding mother of Planned Parenthood and a very early birth control activist during the early 20th century. She did not stop working in her later years by any means. She remained doggedly active in birth control research and advocacy. In the 1950s, Sanger met biologist Gregory Pincus, who had been doing some experiments with early in vitro fertilization, and asked him to begin researching how hormone therapy of some kind might be used as contraception. I guess Gregory Pincus made a big splash in the 1950s because he was impregnating rabbits with in vitro fertilization, which I think is kind of funny. They did not realize this when they were kind of having their early discussions, but there already was a scientist named Carl Gerasi living in Mexico City who had already created a pill made out of the Mexican wild yam, which functioned like a progestin analog. I'm pausing here because this makes me laugh also because it involves wild yams. And have you ever seen the show Grace and Frankie?
No.
Okay, so
I see it on my Netflix thing all the time. Like, you should watch this.
But it's hysterically funny.
Yeah.
But Frankie makes in the first season, she makes this lube for older women, like specifically designed for older women who would like to have sex but are having a hard time because of dryness, out of yams. And so her big selling point is that it's edible.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
I have to see that now.
Yeah, yeah. So yams. Okay.
But this is not the same yams.
Not the same kind of yams. This is a Mexican wild yam. This was effectively the first real birth control pill. Back in the U.S., Sanger helped to arrange for wealthy feminist and widow Catherine McCormick to pay for Pincus's research, Gregory Pincus's research. In 1956, the FDA approved the use of Pincus's pill for medical reasons, like irregular periods. It was, after all, still illegal in many states to provide birth control. So even though the first pill comes onto the market in the late 1950s, you technically could not prescribe it for birth control. You could prescribe it as a way to regulate periods, to ease menstrual cramps, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is this kind of huge spike in women going to their doctors and saying, oh, my cramps are horrible. I heard that there's this new pill, right? So that even before the FDA approved the pill for birth control use, millions of people were already on it.
Mm-hmm.
In 1960, the FDA approved Enovid, the first real contraceptive pill. And by 1965, just 5 years later, 6.5 million American women were on the pill.
Wow.
That's a huge, that's just like boom, right? I put that there because.
No, that is. And I'm just thinking like Griswold v. Connecticut is 1965. So. God, and just
that moved really quickly.
Years, mm-hmm. 6.5 million women are on the pill. That's insane. That's awesome. Okay.
Which I think, again, just proves that there was a demand, right? Like women sure. wanted this. Yeah. Not just women, people, right?
People, families, anybody. Right. So, you know, that just shows, right, that women wanted and expected to be able to obtain birth control from their healthcare providers. But laws preventing women from accessing safe birth control from their medical practitioners led to some pretty important court cases, as we've alluded to earlier. Estelle Griswold was the executive director of Planned Parenthood League of Connecticut, and Dr. C. Lee Buxton was a doctor and professor at Yale Medical School. And in an attempt to get the 1897 Connecticut law overturned, they opened a birth control clinic. Okay, so again, when we were talking about kind of forcing the hand, right?
Yeah.
They decided they wanted to overturn this. So they open up a very public birth control clinic.
It's the same thing Margaret Sanger did in 1915 or 1917.
Right. Mm-hmm. So they open up a birth control clinic. They're in business like, I don't know, 5-10 days, something like that.
Right.
Were arrested and convicted in state court of selling contraceptives. They were each fined $100. Griswold and Buxton appealed to the Supreme Court of Errors of Connecticut, claiming that the 1897 law violated the U.S. Constitution. The Connecticut court upheld the conviction, and Griswold and Buxton then appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which reviewed the case in 1965. And the Supreme Court decided in a 7-2 decision that the law violated the right to marital privacy and could not be enforced against married people. So over the next 10 years, so between 1965 and 1973, the court expanded this fundamental substantive right to privacy beyond the bonds of marriage. So in ruling that the state could not ban the use of contraceptives by anyone in the case of Einstead v. Baird in 1972.
Eisenstadt.
Right. So
but Eisenstadt referred to unmarried women.
Right.
Or unmarried
or
people.
All women. Yeah. Unmarried people. Right. So Griswold v. Connecticut is married women can get birth control. And then it takes another, 7 years before all women. So unmarried mm-hmm. women. So essentially between that time, you have women kind of gaming the system in a way,
yeah.
like they'll show up to their doctor wearing a wedding ring and,
yes.
and say, you know, even if they're not married and say that they want birth control.
Right.
There's
a lot of wink, wink, nudge, nudging right. happening.
Right. So Eisenstadt v. Baird is in 1972 and then Roe v. Wade in 1973. Jump in here too. Like from Sonia, when were you born in the 80s?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to.
I was born in 1995. No, I'm just kidding.
I don't know. When I hear that, I'm like, God, you could be my kid. That's so weird. So, yeah, I mean, I just want to pause here for a second and think about this, because this is so mind-blowing, like how fast all of this change has happened. I mean, I was personally, not all of us, but me, I was born in the 70s.
Right.
And so, like, this was within my lifetime. And even to me, this seems like something that is, like, spoken about, like, it was so long ago.
Right, yeah.
So I'm sure that women who were born in the 90s must feel this even more so than I do. And it seems to me that this seems to be kind of a major push or platform within the mainstream feminist movement now, is to try and make millennials essentially realize how the rights that they take for granted are, in the grand scheme of things, very, very new.
Right.
And I think this can explain some of the, I don't know, dare I say, frustration that older women who literally lived through this and experienced it firsthand have. This frustration they have with younger women who don't realize really how tenuous this is and how new these rights are that they just take for granted.
Absolutely. This is something that I think that we've come back to, we've circled back to in each one of our three so far episodes in this series, that is this idea of contingency, right? And that there's nothing saying that this was like a straightforward march towards progress.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're absolutely right to say that young women today feel as though this is just a fundamental right that cannot be taken away, because it's always been there, right?
Mm-hmm.
They've always had the ability to go to their pediatrician and ask for birth control when they were 16, 17 years old. That's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
But now I think we're seeing that those rights can be very easily overturned. At least those of us either with kind of looking back towards history and how recent this has taken place, right?
Mm-hmm.
And something that we're going to talk about more in the future, too, is how there wasn't a moment after Roe v. Wade where this wasn't contentious,
right?
People have been fighting tooth and nail since the moment Roe v. Wade was decided to get it overturned again. And there's really nothing saying that the right circumstances won't line up and it will be overturned. That's what contingency is all about, right? Anything could happen given the right circumstances. So I think you're absolutely right to say that this is where some of this frustration comes from.
Mm-hmm. Coming off of that,
yeah,
with that contingency and that kind of pushback after Roe v. Wade, we have even, you know, very current instances.
Yeah. And obviously we saw in those statistics that in 1960, the FDA approves the pill. Just 5 years later, you have 6.5 million women using hormonal birth control.
Mm-hmm.
Since the 1960s, birth control has occupied this really odd position in our culture. It is intensely common. The Guttmacher Institute says that 99% of women who have ever had sex have used some kind of contraceptive. 62% of all women of reproductive age are currently using a contraceptive method. 77% of married women use contraceptives. 90% of cohabitating unmarried women use some method of birth control. 89% of Catholics, 90% of Protestants, 67% of women use hormonal methods such as the pill, patch, or an IUD. So this is the overwhelming majority of women use some form of birth control. That's not to say that all of them use the pill.
Right.
This also could refer to condoms, right?
Diaphragms.
Whatever, right.
Yeah.
But 89% of Catholics, 90% of Protestants, even when the Catholic Church still today teaches that birth control is a sin.
Mm-hmm.
That's taking the decision-making out of God's hands. So we have this really paradoxical thing happening. Religious women in this country, obviously, according to these statistics, are able to both follow a religious practice that says don't use birth control, but also use birth control.
Yeah.
So even though it's overwhelmingly used in this country, at the same time, this has still been the subject of debate politically, even just a couple of years ago, in 2012, during some of the debates over the Affordable Care Act and some of the birth control mandate that exists within the Affordable Care Act, there was this sort of controversy that blew up between conservative political commentator Rush Limbaugh and a young woman, then a 30-year-old law student at Georgetown University named Sandra Fluke. Sandra Fluke, just as a background, was invited to speak before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee to speak out against the conscience clause that existed with, right? It exists within the Affordable Care Act.
Yes,
and this conscience clause allows hospitals, colleges, other places, institutions that are affiliated with religious organizations to deny access to things like birth control because they don't believe in them because of their religion, right? And Sandra Fluke testified before Congress that she had this health insurance that came from Georgetown law that denied her the ability to get her birth control paid for by her insurance.
And I think it's important to point out, too, from what I remember of her testimony, she was actually talking about women that she knew and friends of hers that she knew that had endometriosis and other types of, I don't know, ailments or whatever that are helped by birth control, right? So it wasn't even like she was, from what I understand, it's not like she was even going saying like, I'm denied it, right?
Right, exactly.
I didn't mean to cut off.
No, that's okay. That's perfectly fine. And she also was talking about just how expensive this can be. I think sometimes we forget because it is so ubiquitous that depending on what kind of health insurance you have, if you're using hormonal birth control, it can be quite expensive. So Sandra Fluke gives her testimony and then Rush Limbaugh on his show makes this statement a couple of days later. He says, "So, Ms. Fluke and the rest of you feminazis out there, here's the deal. If we're going to pay for your contraceptives and thus pay for you to have sex, we want something for it. And I'll tell you what it is. We want you to post the videos online so we can all watch." So I find this really interesting for many, many reasons. One is this linking that he's making between sexual promiscuity and birth control. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, Rush Limbaugh doesn't have 200 children.
Right.
Right. Rush Limbaugh doesn't. He's not driving like one of those conversion vans with like 17 car seats in the back. So it's a reminder here that everyone uses birth control, and yet people still have these really strong reactions when women ask for birth control access, as though it's women sort of flaunting some sort of sexual promiscuity in the in the public space, even though birth control is a men's issue too, right?
Exactly. He doesn't have 200 children. It's very much a men's issue.
Right. Absolutely. So I think that there's a subtext here. I think that a lot of times it's argued that it's a religious issue, but I think that what we're seeing is that people who say that they feel a certain way about this issue because of their religious convictions are still using birth control, right? So I think that there's actually something else going on. What I think it is that it's about defending a certain ideological worldview that relies on women occupying quote-unquote traditional roles, right? That if women have access to birth control, they don't have to be tied to the home. They don't have to be at the whim of their uteruses, right? They can make decisions about what they do. And this goes all the way back to what Margaret Sanger argued for in the early 20th century. That was her argument, that if women don't have access to birth control, women can never be liberated. And I think that there's still a backlash against that specifically.
And
I hope that was articulate.
No, it is. And I don't want to water down your point, too, but also to bring up the this kind of othering of women who use birth control.
Yes.
I can use birth control in my family because I'm a upstanding citizen. Mm-hmm. But those people over there, they can't have access to free birth control because they're going to bring down society, you know?
Yeah. And it comes back again to class, too. That a lot of times the argument is, well, birth control is fine, but the government shouldn't pay for it. So that means that those with means will have access to birth control again, and those without means will not. Further stigmatizing those women.
Right.
And kind of entrapping them in a cycle where they can't get birth control and they can't get abortions.
So pro-abortion and anti-abortion advocates each proclaim deep-seated fundamental beliefs on how, when, and if abortions are to be performed. The purpose of this podcast is not to debate which side is right and which side is wrong, but to show that the questions that consume us today are nothing new.
Right. To show kind of the long story here.
Right. Advancements in medicine have profoundly changed our understanding of fetal development. Sonograms alone show us visual pictures of bean-sized fetuses, which expectant mothers proudly display on their refrigerators and Facebook pages. Yet fetal imagery, a favorite of the anti-abortion movement, presents the fetus as a primary and autonomous thing, treating the mother's body as a mere environment in which this new life can flourish. Or essentially, the mother's body is completely non-existent.
Right.
Right. The baby floats in this space vacuum devoid of the host body that it occupies, the mother's body. So a fundamental question remains, at what point does a fetus become a life? The definition of a parasite is an organism that lives on or in another organism known as the host from the body of which it attains nutriment. So surely that defines a fetus, right? Connected to its mother through an umbilical feeding tube. But it's not that simple.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
The human capacity to reason tells us that it is much more complex than that. And as we have learned throughout the series on women's reproduction, abortion and birth control have literally been practiced since the dawn of time. This is literally something that humans have been doing since we began walking upright. And I would imagine even before that. Notions of natural biology, and I say natural kind of in quotations, such as reproduction, are really culturally and historically constructed. So the debate pits the autonomy and the embodiment of a woman against the biopower of society and the state. And these are two very hefty factors and are not to be discussed lightly. Ethical questions aside, the survey of abortion practice and birth control and law since America's inception allows us the opportunity to explore fluctuating power relations in regards to sexuality and biopolitics. Mm-hmm. The overarching laws on abortion restriction never eliminated abortion. They just shifted discourse and action to alternate areas. Laws that were enacted over 100 years ago with the pragmatic and some would argue selfish reasons of physicians are now contested on almost exclusively moral grounds. Yet the rhetorical public discourse has historically never meshed with the private discourse and implementation of birth control and abortion. The United States continues to grapple with the ideological, scientific, and pragmatic questions that surround abortion. As new generations are born, societal dogma changes. The cultural construction of abortion presently is not the same as it was in the 1600s, the 1800s, nor will it be the same in the 2100s. The ever-changing abortion debate illuminates how repression and power not only function in a law subject binary, but are also embedded within the system of society itself.
All right. Thanks for listening.
See ya.
Bye.
I know it's
too
close.
It's kind of like you're embracing, right? Like, let's snuggle and record.
Should I move it an inch?
If you want to. You come a long way, baby. And just to pause here for a minute. Wait, no, you have to say this because I wasn't born in the 70s. Okay.
Because feminism